Let's start at the
beginning. Tell me something about your early background and education.
Okay, I grew up in Wisconsin. My ancestors all on all sides came from Germany and Ireland in the early 1840s and settled in Milwaukee and in the southeastern part of the state. And that's where all my forebears are located, in the various cemeteries around the town of Erin or Mayville, Wisconsin. My mother was Irish and my father German, and that was a natural combination in those days because of the mingling of these two groups of people. But I grew up most of my life in Wausau, Wisconsin. My father was a lawyer, and I came to the university as a freshman in 1934. And for a number of years, my two brothers and I were all here at the same time. Things were cheaper then, more possible. And I value my college education as more highly than any other part of my life, I think. Those 4 years stand out in my memory more vividly than any of the rest of the other 61 years of my life. This university suited me just fine, and I think I got as much out of it, curricular and extracurricular, as I possibly could.
What did you study?
I was a history major, and after I graduated, I spent 1 year in a summer school at Columbia Teachers College, got a master's degree in history and education and a teacher's license. Education has been my interest, always. And when I was in politics, like in the legislature, I was on the education committee. When my last political experience were 9 years on the Madison Board of Education, where in between those experiences, I taught a couple of years, which gave me an undying admiration for the hard work that teachers do. It was just the never-ending burden, which I found extremely strenuous and gave up because it was too strenuous. But education, and then of course I worked for 20 years for the university. Education has been my main interest.
Getting back to college, we'll go into those other things in more, more detail. But before we do, would you, you mentioned extracurricular activities also when you were in college. What interested you there?
Well, I was interested in politics and the student body. I was elected to the Board of Control of the Daily Cardinal, which was wound up my college career in a slam bang fashion with a strike on the Cardinal.
Well, will you tell me about that?
Well, it was a very important experience and a very important issue. The strike was a question of anti-Semitism, and I was president of the board, and in those days, on the Cardinal, the old board would elect a new editor and then retire, and a new board took over the next day. This time, in my senior year, we elected for the second time in a row a Jewish editor, and we had been told that if another Jew was elected editor, there would be a major ruckus. But we chose what we thought to be the best qualified person, who happened to be Jewish. And he took office at a banquet one night, and the next day the new board came in and fired him, which left the old board, of which I was the president, in a position of participating heavily in a staff strike of the Cardinal, which lasted 6 weeks. We published a strike Cardinal every day out at the East Side News, Mr. Marshall Brown. And it was an issue that was widely covered in the press all over the country because the subject was so sensitive. And we split the faculty down the middle. We made a schism between Selig Perlman and Edwin Whitty, who had been friends for 50 years.
My goodness.
And Mr. Whitty's son was on the new Cardinal board that fired the editor. It was a profound effect. And it was very, very tense. The Silver Shirts, Nazi groups offered to come to our work with our opponents during the struggle. And it had to be solved. In those days, Parents' Weekend was a very important occasion. And the president, Mr. Dykstra, who was new in Madison at that time, thought that we could not have the strike go on into Parents' Weekend. And we had planned for a stockholders' meeting. We were getting proxies signed, the stockholders being all the students in the university. And we had proxies were signed for about 4,200 for a stockholders' meeting, which we were going to have at the field house, which could have been just a disaster.
Oh, gracious.
So Mr. Dykstra took firm hold and asked Dean Garrison, who was one of the great corporation lawyers in the United States and dean of the law school, to redraw the Articles of Incorporation
of the
Daily Cardinal.
Of the Cardinal.
And to arrange for the election, to vacate the old corporation, arrange for an election of the new board. And when that event occurred, we lost. Our side lost by 26 votes. It was 26. I say 26. It might be 260 votes in the largest student election that the campus had ever had. So that was the end of it. But the experience itself, I think, is one that we all treasure. Fanny Taylor, Bob Taylor, well, many, many people who are in Madison now were important parts of that effort. And it was an education that you could not have gotten in any other way.
Must have been. This is a sort of precursor of later discrimination problems, isn't it?
Yes, and much more serious in many ways. This was before the World War II. The Nazi movements were springing up all over the world in various places. We never thought we'd see them here. But when the issue was drawn, it was very clear. There was no question. But the motive for the firing of Richard Davis was that he was Jewish.
And he was never reinstated?
Never reinstated, no. And the Cardinal went on.
Oh, yes.
Everybody lived through it.
Yes, it certainly did. Well, when you would... How soon after completing your schooling did you start teaching?
Well, I taught. I took 1 year out to get a graduate degree in New York, and I taught 1 year at Lake Mills, 39 and 40. And my teaching career had that year and 2 other years later. It's the dimmest part of my career. I did not feel I was a success in any way. But after 1 year of teaching, well, my husband finished law school. We were married, and that altered.
Changed your plans
a bit? Yeah. Although we'd had made plans for years, but in those days, you didn't get married if you weren't through school and you didn't have a job. I would never have gone to my father and said, I want to get married and I expect you to support me. You just didn't do that.
Well, a lot of that changed during the war, I think, where people did not necessarily finish their schooling before they married.
Yeah, everybody was leaving. And I had that experience along with everybody else. I went home to have my baby.
You did?
In Wausau, yeah. And all my friends were there, and we were a large baby buggy group brigade. These were girls that I had grown up with. We were all home, or most of us were home again with our babies.
This was during the war?
During the war, yeah.
Well, that changed a lot of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
I guess. Well, what I'm aware that you did some work for the government during the war. How did that fit in with having a baby?
Well, it was all pre-baby, of course.
I see.
It, no matter what the war did to change, the prejudices and difficulties of women were just were great, as great then as they've been before or since. I had a hard time finding a good job in Washington after we were married. I did wind up as, well, for a while I was even the only person in the patents department of the Alien Property Custodian's Office. And for a brute few heady weeks, I actually licensed American firms to use German and Hungarian patents that had been seized by the government, not knowing anything about what I was doing, of course. But fortunately, they got a good staff organized around me, and then I went back to doing what I was able to do, write a few press releases and a little report and help out with a speech and all that.
That's sort of different activity, isn't
yeah.
it? How long did this last?
Not very long, about a year. Then my husband was in the Navy, and I went to Wausau and had my baby. We went back to Washington in 1944 and stayed there. 1944, yes. And Jim then worked at the White House and for the Secretary of State. And we lived there for another couple of years. But I was always very homesick. Everybody in Washington was from somewhere else, and I was very anxious to get back. And I was glad that we promptly made the break and came to Madison to live.
Well, what was your husband doing in the White House?
Well, he had been the law clerk to Justice James Burns on the Supreme Court. And then when Mr. Burns left to go to the White House to be war mobilizer, Jim went overseas, but then he came back and worked for Burns. And then after Roosevelt's death and Truman was president, Burns became Secretary of State, so Jim had a couple of marvelous years.
And he just continued working for him.
Yeah. He went to the peace conferences in Paris. And yeah, he had a wonderful time. I stayed home with a couple of little kids.
You didn't go to Paris?
Then. No.
You told me something the other day about going to the White House.
No, that
tell
was...
Tell me about that occasion.
Yeah, that was another heady experience. And that had happened in 1940. In the fall, during the campaign for Roosevelt's third term, I volunteered my services at the Democratic National Committee Women's Division, where I was kind of a typist and stranger. But on the day, and that only lasted for a couple of weeks, on the day of after the election in 1940, we watched Mrs. Roosevelt. We were standing in the streets to watch her go in the big open cars that they used then, up to the Union Station and come back with the president who had been at Hyde Park for the election. And we saw that. Then I went over to Woodard and Lothrop where I worked as a clerk in the better dresses. I say teaching was the worst part of my career. I think being a clerk was the, that was my least talent. But anyway, I had this note to call the White House. And of course, everybody was agog, including me. But they invited me that night to a party at the White House for the staff of the Democratic National Committee. And when I got there, there were only 20 people, and we got to meet the president. And I, as I told you the other day, I just happened to be pushing the wheelchair of a lady who had worked, a very bright and able woman who had worked for the National Committee. And, of course, the president found in her a kindred soul. And she stopped, and he had a long conversation with her, and I was in on it.
Because you were pushing the chair.
Just happened to push the chair, which is really one of my treasured memories. But of course, I was like a lot of other people. I simply adored him.
Roosevelt.
And as well. Yeah. And it's come very much to my mind as we celebrate his 100th birthday this year.
Had your family been Democrats?
Always. for four generations. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, and my father were all members of the Wisconsin legislature, and so I was, too.
That's quite a tradition.
Yeah, it really is. I have a daughter that's making noises now about running for the legislature. In many ways, I hope she doesn't do it, but I...
Why do you hope she doesn't?
Well, I think she's... I hope for the same reason my mother hoped I'd never do such things. She has two children, and she works very hard. She has a career and lives in Milwaukee, and I think she's got too much to do. This ought to be stricken from here. I don't want anybody to hear that I'm talking about my daughter and organizing her life for her. She'd have a fit. My mother was tactful. She never said anything.
I see. Well, your husband and you did come back to Wisconsin.
And we chose Madison. He joined he worked for the federal government for a year. He was assistant United States attorney for a year or two when we first came back. And then he became one of the founding partners of La Follette, Sinnigan & Doyle. And that's where he served for 18 years, worked for 18 years before he was appointed to the bench. And during that time was my political time.
You were saying that this was the period of time when you did your political work.
Yes. I was very active, and the Democratic Party was just beginning to emerge. And there were a number of us that devoted a great deal of time to it. And it was our social life, our family life, our friendships were among them. And now, as we're all older looking back on it, it was a great period when we were just getting started.
Who were some of these people?
Well, Gaylord and Carrie Lee Nelson, and Pat Lucy, Marion and Hoss Wilkie. Tom and Eleanor Fairchild. There were lots of us, many judges now, many former this or that, because we're all getting older. But it was a wonderful period. I found myself, when I was in the legislature, I was elected by surprise. Of course, we all were in 1948.
What do you mean by surprise?
We were not expected to win. And it was when Truman was not expected to win.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, none of us were expected to get anywhere. I was quite appalled when I discovered I had been elected to the legislature. I had three preschool children, and I really hadn't counted on having a political career.
But you campaigned, hadn't you?
Yes, and I enjoyed that. Campaigning is lots of fun. Holding office I've always found a little more difficult than getting around talking to people. But Gaylord was elected to the state senate, and I was elected to the assembly. There was no polling in those days, so the results were truly a surprise. The only poll we had was at the senior high schools, and that showed that Truman was carrying Madison. And we thought that was because he'd been here and kids had seen him, you know, and he was all excited about having him
here.
He came, yeah. And never thought that it had any greater significance than that. So we were all elected. I don't think partisan politics is as much fun now as it was then. Once you have a lot of successful candidates, office holders running for re-election, you have the party disintegrates. You have a Kastenmeier group and a Nelson group and a Lucy group or whatever, and all the fun of that whole period, that whole unified experience is sort of gone. Carl Thompson ran for governor then, you know, and he came very close to winning, although you can believe it or not, my husband managed that campaign.
And Thompson campaign?
Yeah, in 1948. And our total expenditure for the whole campaign was $5,000.
Oh my goodness.
And he almost won. That's what gave us kind of hope. But later on, I found that I'm a rather independent turn of mind. And I really did not enjoy the partisan. I didn't have enough loyalty or commitment, maybe, to be able to go into a caucus and do what they told me to do, the majority of the Democrats. So when I was elected to the legislature, there were 24 Democrats. That was up from 12 of the year before. And among those was Patrick Lucy, who was a new stranger in town. And he was elected at the same time I was. And Bill Duffy from Green Bay, Tom Taylor from Racine. We had a little group of young people.
Was Lucy in the assembly?
Just served one term. And then he ran for Congress over in the 3rd District. The second term that I was in, Bill Proxmire reared up and became a member of this legislature. He had defeated a very respectable, elderly Democratic farmer from Sun Prairie, John Blaska. And he had done it by going door to door. He talked to every voter in the whole district. And he was a stranger to everybody, but he won. And of course, that became an interesting political history.
Do you recall any particular issues that came up when you were in the assembly?
Well, we were generally just sort of a thorn in people's sides, I think. As I say, I was interested in education, and I served on the Education Committee, and that was my main occupation. It was the reorganization of school districts, in which we virtually abolished the little one-room school district in Wisconsin, cut the number of districts from 4,000 and some to 200-300, I think. And in those days, in that first or second term, the first time that the state budget went over $200 million, and everybody was appalled. And of course, now we're talking about $4.5 billion, and it's a whole different world. But then we had also a lot of procedural problems that we worked on. Reapportionment. The state hadn't been reapportioned since 1920, and although the Constitution required it. So we were agitating. We were not strictly successful there for a couple of years. And finally, it was a lawsuit, I think, that brought it about.
Hmm.
And the Supreme Court of the United States. One man, one vote. Decisions made a difference, too.
Oh, yes.
But I don't feel that I have had any great, terrific success. There had only been a few women in the legislature before that, and for many years before I came, there had been none. When I was elected, there was a woman from Chippewa Falls, Sylvia Raley, who became a good friend. She was a Republican lady. And she served 3 terms, I served 2. So she was a comfort to me. And I didn't mind being the only woman. We had little incidents that occurred, of course. One time I was fleeing from a call on the house, that is when they bring everybody in and lock the doors and make you stay for some political purpose. This had to do with General MacArthur's return from China, as you remember. I ran to hide in the women's room, and that required that the male sergeant at arms come walking into the ladies' room. It was about noon on a certain day, and the women were going out to lunch. A lot of women workers. They were just appalled. Everybody was frozen with fright when Norris Kelman came into the women's room. That was the result. And this was an interesting feminist battle, which I waged on behalf of a young woman who was a law student who wanted to be on the sergeant-at-arms staff. And those are the people that run errands, carry messages, set up meeting rooms, do all kinds of scut work around. This young woman was turned down because she was a woman. And there had never been a woman on the sergeant-at-arms staff. And so there was a great to-do. And again, one of my losing battles. They had retired men. They had men with physical disabilities, epileptics, and one thing and another. Old men working as sergeants. But they couldn't, but a woman, they said, couldn't carry a typewriter. Couldn't run an errand like that. So that was lost. That battle was lost, and of course ultimately won. And it was a big to-do. My running into the ladies' room was partly to demonstrate that they needed a lady on the sergeant-at-arms staff, but it turns out they didn't.
He came in anyway.
Yeah, a man could do a woman's work, but a woman couldn't do a man's work. They had, at that time, it was decided there were two places in state service where women were not to work. One in the Central State Hospital for the Criminal Insane up at Waupun, and the other was the legislature, which was not safe, they felt. And I don't know, maybe it wasn't. I never had any problem, but a younger girl, I suppose, conceivably would, from what we hear now about legislators.
Yes. You only did two terms. Is that because you, yeah, you chose not to
run? I chose
again?
Not to run in 1952. I'm not just sure why, but I was kind of tired of it. And I also was interested in the campaign in 1952, which was the big, that was the Eisenhower, Stevenson, McCarthy, Fairchild.
That was it?
In 1952, and it was very important.
Quite a campaign.
Yeah, and I ran it for state treasurer that year, which gave me an opportunity to travel all over the whole state and participate in that campaign, and I enjoyed it very much. Mrs. Fairchild and I went together. We were out for 6 weeks. Not, we'd come home Friday nights, but we were traveling all that time, and we had a very interesting experience, but of course lost the election, which was to be expected. I have never mind. That's, I've lost twice. That was one of them. And I, my life has always been so full that I never really terribly troubled if I don't win what I'm after. I think one of the problems with me as a politician, I think of a lot of people, is that I never could be persuaded that I was the only one that could do something. That was Mr. Stevenson's problem, too. He used to say, I remember, we were good friends of his. Say, Hubert Humphrey's a fine man. Wouldn't he make an excellent president? He could never believe that he was the only person in the world that was suited for that job. And I certainly had that feeling, too, about my legislative duties. So I felt it was time for me to do something else.
Well, you went on and did do something else.
Mm-hmm.
Is this when you became a member of the Dane County Board of Supervisors?
Yeah, in 1953. And I was on there for 7 years.
How did you happen to do that?
Well, the person in our ward was just not going to run again. And I was told about this and asked if I would permit my name to win at the last minute. Nobody knew that the incumbent wasn't going to run, except the incumbent and his managers. So I went in 5 minutes before the filing date with my papers and turned out to be the only one. It was kind of a tricky little thing to do. But I was elected, and then I was re-elected 2 more times. And I resigned from the county board when we moved out of the ward, out of the 13th ward. But that was an interesting experience. And I was the only woman all that time. And I think everybody forgot I was a woman. Although there are all of the messages to the board, all reports for that 7-year period are all start out Mrs. Doyle and gentlemen. I was, because all that time I was the only woman there. And during that time, I became pregnant with Anne, went through a very long pregnancy. She came about 3 weeks later than I thought she was supposed to arrive. And it worked out that I never missed a meeting of the board or a committee meeting, either before or after her birth. 1954. But nobody noticed. Nobody said a word. And in fact, the chairman of the board, that was 1954, was a year that my husband ran for governor in the Democratic primary. And so there were pictures of the family around various places. The chairman of the board said to me that he had seen our family picture somewhere. And I said, but that's not the whole family. He said, what do you mean? I said, we have a baby. You have a baby? When did you have a baby? I said, about 3 weeks ago. And he never. I had been contributing all those years to, or several years, to the flower fund. We all put in a dollar so that anybody goes to the hospital to get a bouquet of flowers from the board. Nobody ever sent me any flowers. Nobody ever paid any attention to the fact that I had a baby. And I think really, truly, I'd sort of fit into the woodwork there.
And sounds like it.
Yeah, nobody, my colleagues simply did not notice. Nobody was ever very restrained about me. I've taken a lot of abuse various places, public and private. But it wasn't that they were embarrassed to talk about the baby. They just didn't know.
That's funny. What were your responsibilities on the board?
Well, I was secretary of everything. I remember Jim saying in those days that women's rights will be established when the woman does not have to be the secretary of every committee. But I was on the public health committee, public welfare. And then my black
What were some of your other responsibilities besides the dog claims?
Well, my biggest responsibility, and the one for which I bore a great deal of the burden, was a reorganization of the juvenile court system in Dane County. When I first went on the board of the county board, there was one juvenile judge, Judge Proctor, handling, and one juvenile probation officer who handled 1,200 cases a year. It was a kind of a farce, and it became a matter of great concern. There was a joint committee made up by appointees of the mayor, and I was sort of the dual appointment because it was a joint responsibility of the city council and the Dane County Board. And it was that was an educational and very interesting experience. Resulted in the reorganization of the juvenile justice system, which of course has been revamped several times since because circumstances have changed so much that handling of young people is very different. In the course of that, I wrote an article published by Harper's Magazine called What Nobody Knows About Juvenile Delinquency, which got a great deal of comment all over the country. And I found a very satisfying experience. I don't think we did anything to turn bad kids into good kids, which is what the whole system is all about. But I think we did make a sensible reorganization of the department. And Judge Bruner became the juvenile judge at that time. Of course, as I say, it's all expanded terrifically now.
How is it? You said everything was different now. How is it different?
Well, there's a large staff of workers in the department. There's much more service available to kids. Kids' civil rights have been established in a way that they never were before. And they have rights to lawyers, and lawyers were not permitted in juvenile court previously.
They weren't?
No. And it was all just all informal supervision that very seldom tried a young person for anything. Guilt was never determined, guilt or innocence, in any formal way. It was just always presumed that the kid was guilty of whatever he brought him in for, and then they put him on probation, or he'd be assigned to come in once a month or something to see Mr. Amborn. It was all just very informal, very loose, very useless. Whether what we're doing now is more, detailed, more personal. But, and I suppose in many cases it does help. But we still haven't solved that problem, of course.
That was one of the major things you did. Anything else that comes to mind in that period of time?
Well, no, it was just, of course, the county budget and those things that were continuous responsibilities. That budget was always, and I think it still is, always wound up. And sometimes we stay all night to finish it. On the night before the deer hunting season began, we could never
go. This was the deadline.
Never have deer hunting without the budget being finished. So we would do that. And there were many late nights that we spent on that. I worked as a board member on the public health and public welfare with the county nurses. And mostly just, you know, as their representatives on the board. And I don't remember any particular important events that occurred. But that also was a very interesting learning experience. For instance, I discovered that Stoughton was a city, that beautiful, idyllic little place that you drive through, where they had to alternate the workloads of the social workers, the Dane County social workers, because the burden in Stoughton was so heavy, nobody could bear it for very long. There were more social problems in Stoughton 30 years ago than in any other place in Dane County.
I wouldn't have thought that.
No, I wouldn't have either. I was surprised. There are other many surprising little things you learn.
Well, you did that for about 7 years. That's a long time.
Yeah. I never had any trouble getting reelected after, ever. I do remember I had some kids circulating a little leaflet for me. I had just token opposition, but in which I listed my qualifications, and one of them being a housewife and mother of three children. And I got one of them back, with a note on the back saying, if you're a housewife and mother of three children, why in hell don't you stay home and take care of them? But I had not many incidents like that.
Well, there's still people around who feel that wives and mothers should stay home and tend to their domestic responsibilities, not be doing other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just wonder. You know, it worked out all right for us, but I don't know. Maybe I should have stayed home. I would have gone balmy, I think. I think there are some people, you're probably one of them, who have to have some outlet of your very own, something that you do well and your family doesn't do and isn't in a...
It's something that's yours.
Mm-hmm. That, a skill own. That belongs to you.
Your own personal accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Well, now, did you stop this because, I mean, you just decided not to do it anymore?
No, we moved.
Oh.
We moved from the 13th Ward, which is over near Vilas Park, to our house on Prospect in Chadburn.
And that's a different ward?
A different ward, yeah. So I resigned. And then... we had been looking for a better house for a long time. And so it was the next year then that I ran for the school board.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, that was something I sort of had in my mind all along. And I had had, as I told you, 2 years I taught out in the Village of Oregon. 2 years while I was on the county board during that time. Which made the burden very heavy.
Well, I would think so.
And then I I was, as I say, not a successful teacher. I does not consider that a very successful part of my life. But the school board did kind of interest me. And when I decided to run, I did that. Just sort of decided on my own. Nobody was howling for me to run for the school board. But, and I always have done very well when the whole city was involved. I got lots of votes. And so it was a natural. I ran against a lady that had been appointed to the board. There had always been one woman on the board. And her duties were to choose the colors for the various school buildings and read the plays for the Madison Theater Guild to see whether they were suitable for being performed in school buildings and stuff like that. And I did that sort of thing for a while. But then I realized that no matter what colors I chose for the school, the new schools, we had a lot of new ones in those days, no matter what colors I chose, when I go out to see the school later, I would swear that I hadn't. You know, I think what happened was I would go out with the art supervisor, and she and I would discuss the colors and make our selections. Like the Abraham Lincoln School. I know I didn't pick that orange color they put on the lockers in there, but I think then they went ahead and did what they were going to do anyway. I don't think they paid much attention to what we said. The last school I did was Memorial High School.
Oh.
And I did choose those bricks, and I still think they're very beautiful.
Yes, I like those bricks. My son went to Memorial the first year it opened.
Yeah, well, that was just about
when I saw a lot of that building.
Well, and I enjoyed being on the school board, and I've missed it, although 9 years was sufficient, not only for me, but for the board. I think until I went on, I was the only uninvited guest onto that board in many, many, many years. Vacancies had been filled by appointment in between elections, and then the elected person... then the appointed person would be elected. So it was very carefully controlled, and Mr. Glenn Stevens had been on for 37 years, and Dr. Hegel, over 30. He was on 34 years before he retired, I think. But the board assumed no responsibility in those days. The budget had a very strong superintendent, Phil Falk, for many years. He was good friends with everybody on the board. So I was viewed with a great deal of suspicion when I first went on. And then for a good long time after that, too, I guess. But school boards, it seemed to me, all over the country, had isolated themselves so much from the political life of the cities. Any questions you raise about the schools, they'd yell, "Foul politics, you know, why are you interfering?" When they got into trouble, they had no constituencies left, which I think is why they have come to such a terrible state in the big cities, particularly, of the country. For generations, the public did not participate in anything having to do with the public schools. Now, of course, they're very much, everybody's participating. And in a way, it's nice. I miss the board. Because you cannot believe what you read in the papers about what the board is doing.
You can't.
I miss not being in on what's really going on. Because I found so often the reporters would simply cover the board meetings and lose track entirely of what was really the main purpose of the meeting. And just decide for themselves what the real agenda is. Now, maybe that's not true anymore, but I'd like to be around to see whether it's true or not.
I'm not for certain.
Yeah.
I hope you didn't always have to just pick colors and read plays and things.
No, I didn't. I tried all the time, And I think other people did too. As new people came onto the board, we tried to get the board into the mainstream, the main decision-making power. It had developed to be just the reverse. The staff was making the major decisions and then assuming board approval. And the board was doing the picayune little things, like choosing the colors. I don't mean to say that's picayune little, because we were doing a lot of building and it involved a great deal of expense. But it was the sort of thing that required some special kind of skills, which, of course, the board didn't have, members of the board. Diney Mansfield, whenever there was a question about a bus route, any difficulty with a bus, he would go out as a member of the school board and ride the bus in dispute and see what was going on. And so he was the bus man. I was the color person. You know, it was we had peculiar little responsibility. We tried to reverse that, and I think these newer boards have, to a very large extent, changed that around. They participate a great deal more in what's really the public interest in the schools is all about.
But you didn't feel you made much progress in the years you were on the board?
Well, I suppose we did make progress. It just seems to me there's been a lot more made since. The world has changed a lot. I've been off the board now nearly 10 years, which is hard to believe. But it took an enormous amount of time, of course, too. I would often go from my office at the law school at 4 o'clock over to the board, particularly during negotiating times, and go home at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Ooh.
There were lots of nights like that.
That sounds difficult.
Mm-hmm. It was difficult. It made 9 years about right as a length of time to serve. That's me.
Now, when did you begin working in some capacity at the university?
In 1961. In 1961, I started to work for the university half-time and got a job to start out with in Martha Peterson's office. She was dean of women then. And that was the time when the university was getting interested in the older woman and making educational opportunities available to women who, during the war, had gone home to have their babies, never finished college or whatever. So I worked there for a year or so. And then I became the staff person for the Faculty Student Committee on Human Rights, which was dealing mostly in those days with discrimination in sororities and fraternities. And it was a long and tedious process in which Wisconsin took a lead to get national organizations to remove their discriminatory racial discrimination from their national constitutions. And it was a big thing. It was nationwide struggle. It was the time when Patty Hamilton, you remember, Madison Girl, was pledged to Delta Gamma at Beloit. Maybe you weren't interested in all this.
I wasn't in Wisconsin at that time, but I have heard something about this.
Yeah, and it was a national movement, and we were, of course, as always in such things, Wisconsin is kind of at the forefront, and it was very interesting.
What happened about Patty Hamilton? Was she admitted?
She was not. Delta Gamma at Beloit College had pledged her, but their national officers had said they couldn't do that. And when they persisted, they kicked the Beloit chapter out of National Delta Gamma. That was sort of the beginning of a nationwide struggle on this whole question. And for most organizations, to amend their constitutions required two national conventions. So we set up, and Richard Hartshorn can remember very well, elaborate systems of waiting until they had gone, you know, getting through two national conventions and all these groups. And then getting the amendments so that these groups could be approved on this campus. The time limit set was 1972, and of course by that time nobody cared anymore. Fraternities and sororities had almost all but disappeared. If they did survive, they didn't require any approval. They were just working on their own. It wasn't a matter of life and death to them anymore. And much larger and more important issues were absorbing everybody's attention. So all of our work, when I was getting ready to leave the university, I had two huge file drawers full of all of that work, which we just wrapped up, sent to the archives as a thing where the subject was closed. Nevertheless, it was an interesting thing. And we had national officers from organizations and law firms from New York and other places. And I had hearings on this campus of groups that were held to be in violation of the University of Wisconsin's non-discrimination policies. That was the main thing. Then we also worked on housing discrimination. And in the course of my work for the committee, I became aware of a census of Negro students that was being taken by the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in Madison. And it was unfinished, and Mr. John McGrath, who was conducting it, he was from the outside, he was not a university employee, turned it over to me. And so I was able to finish up a census of American blacks on the campus. I did it once and found that there were about 90. This was an informal census. We asked for names, and then I'd interview some of the people and ask them for names. Then we'd go on. When we began getting all the same names back again, we figured we had just about everybody. It was about 90, a shock to everybody. And was when it was given some publicity. Other Big Ten schools like Michigan, where I suppose in its population a third of the population is black, and Illinois also, found they had probably no more, maybe even less, than we did.
That surprises me. Mm-hmm.
It was very surprising. And that was the beginning of our consideration of the special five-year program that I was connected with.
And well, before we talk about that, I heard you say something about doing a study of students living in paying board and room.
Mm-hmm. In rooming houses. I did that for another committee that I was working for. It was called the Remington Committee that was studying the non-curricular life of students. And I did it kind of on my own. I interviewed 50 students who did not live in organized housing, that is, not in fraternities and sororities, or in dormitories. And I just sent out letters, asked them to come to my office. And I just looked this last few days ago at those interviews. It was really wonderful. Everybody came, and I learned more about students. These were long conversations. They lasted two hours to 3 hours. Usually I added an afternoon for one. And I learned a great deal about students and what life was like. And what makes that important now is, of course, that was just before the life of students changed so substantially that when the troubles began and students demanded and were given their rights as individuals, citizens. All of this changed. Before that, of course, when I was in the Dean of Women's office, a girl came in late, say three nights in a row. There would be a hearing in the Dean's office, and Dean Luberg, who was then the Dean of Students, would come down from Bascom Hall, and somebody from the major department would come. And the girl, and usually her parents, and for these minor infractions, Miss Peterson say, "Now, Debbie, I think it'd be nice if you went home with your mother and father for the rest of this year." And by next fall, if things are better, get in touch with me and I'll see whether we can let you come back to school. All of these things, it's so hard to believe ever happened. That's the way we did things. And that's less than 25 years ago.
That's right.
So, I don't know what, so these interviews reveal very much of what student views of themselves and of the university were. And I think it was one of the nice little things I've got down there in my files is the report of those interviews. Then...
What kind of things did you find out?
Well, one thing that surprised me, and I thought should have gone up in electric lights all over the country, in order to find out how aware students were of student services that were being offered to them, like the counseling center or the student psychiatric services and so on, I asked each one, where would you go if you had a problem that you didn't feel you could solve by yourself? Way over half of them said, I'd go to my mother and father, which I don't think any mother and father ever realized that their children felt that way about them, their college children. But, and that was an eye-opener for me, and I think for a lot of people. One of them would say, my mother and father never went to college, but they have very good judgment about these things. Or, my father was at the university 25 years ago, and he would know and be able to help me decide what I wanted to do. Hardly any of them said I'd go to the dean of men or the dean of women. Most of them hadn't even heard. If you were in a sorority, you would hear about the deans because you would invite them to dinner or something. But if you lived on a little roomy house on Johnson Street, there's one story I may be too long to put in here. One particular boy that has stuck with me, he came from a little town up in northern Wisconsin, and the local judge up there, who in fact was the present Chief Justice, Bruce Vilfus, had taken an interest in him and had helped him financially in other ways to come down here to go to college. He was a football player. And he rented a room on Johnson Street and gave me the details. He was now a senior when I talked to him. He was talking about his freshman and sophomore years, when he never had a meaningful conversation with anybody at this university. He went to he liked to play basketball, so he'd go over to the armory. But it just happened that everybody would come with whole teams, and he never got to play. He went to a mixer for pre-commerce students. Nobody spoke to him, so he didn't. He went through 2 years of total isolation on this campus. And then somebody persuaded him to transfer into the ag school, where he got on a meat judging team and became part of an agricultural fraternity and so on. So everything had turned out right for him. But his account of those 2 years, he had tears and I had tears. It was just so touching. And of course I thought, how could we ever know how many students this happened to in those days, who just left school and never came back. And we never knew about them, and nobody ever helped them. I suppose that's true today, too, maybe even to a greater extent than it was then.
Well, the university is so much larger now, and it makes personal contacts more difficult, I suppose.
Yeah. And living arrangements are so much less organized, and students are spread out all over the whole city. There's no ghetto, student ghetto much anymore. They've torn down all those buildings.
Yes, I guess that's true. And if the individual isn't naturally gregarious and outgoing, it might be very difficult to.
On the other hand, it says students contributing and participating in the life of Madison in the last 15 years in a way that they never did. Students, city council members. Paul Soglin, after all, was a student when his political career was launched in Madison. And I think you'd find all over the city, in campaigns and holding office and participating in various kinds of activity, we find students are now involved on a much broader scale. So maybe there are, in the long run, fewer isolates. But we don't know. We don't really know. And now we have this whole thing about privacy, which means we don't ask. I don't suppose anybody would be approved to just call in random students to talk to them anymore. But that's how we got going in the black student movement, too, was by calling students in. And I had long conversations.
With these 90?
With the 90 black students. And the next year we did it again. And then Miss Peterson was then a vice president of the university and dealing with student affairs. And it was she and I who, she to whom I went, saying, why can't we do something about this? Some of these kids had financial troubles, the ones that I'd met. And so we decided. And then when the federal aid, the basic opportunity grants, which are now going to be cut out, were established, it seemed that we ought to seek out some students and try to encourage a little mixture of color on the campus. So that's what started.
In other words, increase the number of blacks on the...
American blacks, yeah. And it started in a very small way. I wrote letters to people that I knew or knew about who had things to, who had to do with young people, YMCAs in the big cities, and some individuals, and asked them if they knew about students who might want to come to the University of Wisconsin. And we began getting some applications. And the Student Nonviolent Organizing Committee, you remember SNCC, in those days was working in the South in the summertime. Voter registration projects were going on and so on. And a lot of students from this campus, or some students from this campus, were going to Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama in the summertime. And we encouraged them to get, stimulate some interest. And the first year we had 24 students. And it grew from there.
How did you pick? You must have had more than 24 applications.
Yes. We had didn't have any more than 50 applications. We never could decide very well. We had a committee that went over them, a committee of somebody from the Council Center, somebody from the Dean, Letters and Science Dean's office, Chet Rudisilli, Nolan Penn was in the Counseling Center then, and a couple other people who read applications. And just on the basis of the applications and the recommendations, plus our feeling that these ought to be people who are academically as well as financially disadvantaged.
How do you mean?
Well, they all had to take an ACT or an SAT test, and we looked for people who were in the bottom 1% of people who, on the scale of who's going to succeed in the university. We took those that were there. But also they had to have some indications that they could do well.
What kind of indications would you look for?
Well, this is, it's very difficult. What the teachers would say, we dealt with some particularly important people who became important, certain guidance counselors in Chicago or Milwaukee high schools, for instance, who would say such interesting things as, even though she's grown up in public housing, Debbie is a very nice girl,